This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Dominic Crossan, is one of the world's leading scholars of the historical Jesus. This is the study of the real person to whom the Gospels refer and an analysis of the culture, politics, and religion of his time. This historical analysis is often controversial for challenging certain accounts in the Gospels as well as challenging commonly accepted interpretations. Crossan is a former priest. He left the monastery when he found himself unable to pursue the full extent of his convictions and historical research. Crossan is a professor emeritus of DePaul University. His books include The Historical Jesus, Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography, and Who Killed Jesus? His new book is called In Search of Paul, How Jesus' Apostle Opposed Rome's Empire with God's Kingdom. It offers a new interpretation of Paul's writings. Crossan describes Paul as the most dominant figure after Jesus in the New Testament. 13 of its 27 books are attributed to Paul, and about half of another is about him. Why did you want to re-examine Paul?
Because Paul has got a really bad press. It's a major question whether he is, as one of our chapters says, an appealing or an appalling apostle. And the reason is this, that there really are three different Pauls in the New Testament. Conservative Paul, a liberal Paul, and a radical Paul. And it depends upon whether a given letter was really originally, authentically written by Paul or was attributed to him later. That's the issue, really.
When you say that Paul has gotten a bad rep, I think one of the things you're probably talking about is what he said about women. Why don't you quote some, one or two of his most famous passages about
infamous
the submissive role of women.
Let me use the gender controversy as a way of discriminating the three Pauls. The conservative Paul is usually what everyone knows from 1 Timothy, where he says that women are to be at home, and they're not supposed to be teaching men in church, which, by the way, tells us, of course, that they were. You wouldn't have to forbid something that wasn't happening. But in 1 Timothy, women are not to be teaching men in church. They're to be at home. They're to be pregnant. They're to be silent if they have questions, ask their husband. Nice and clear. That's the conservative Paul in 1 Timothy, which was not written by Paul. The liberal Paul would appear, say, in Ephesians and Colossians, also not written by Paul, where he says that women should obey their husbands, but then spends a lot more time telling husbands that they should sacrifice themselves for their wives, something that tends to get forgotten. I call that the liberal Paul. The radical Paul is the one, say, in Corinthians or in Romans, who insists that women are equal to men in the family, in the community, that's the church, in the apostolate. The Paul, for example, who sends the epistle to the Romans, his most important epistle, with a woman. And, of course, she's going to have to then read the epistle, explain the epistle to the communities at Rome. This is the radical Paul, who simply says that in Christ Jesus, there is neither male nor female, slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile, in Christ Jesus.
Well, your new book, In Search of Paul, is co-written with an archaeologist. And is there like archaeological information that helps you determine which of these three Pauls you think is the more authentic?
What we are really doing in archaeology is looking for the archaeology of Paul's theological world, not just his social world. But, for example, all over the Roman Empire, in archaeological digs that you can find, you can't miss them, in coins, in inscriptions, in images, in structures, you're getting a message that Caesar is divine, son of God, God, God from God, Lord, Savior of the world, Redeemer, Liberator, all of that stuff is there. So when Paul walks into Ephesus, for example, he walks under a gate that says that the Imperator Caesar is the son of God. Now, when he talks to his people in Ephesus about Jesus being the Son of God, that is known technically as high treason. So it's precisely the archaeology of Roman imperial theology that makes so much importance for Paul, rather than, well, we know he was in Ephesus, here's what Ephesus looked like in the first century.
Let me quote something from your new book about Paul. You write, "What is newest about this book is our insistence that Paul opposed Rome not because the empire was particularly unjust or oppressive, but because he questioned the normalcy of civilization itself, since civilization has always been imperial, that is, unjust and oppressive." Could you explain that?
Yes, it's an invention. Civilization is an invention, and it has always been imperial. from the first time the Akkadians went roaring down the Mesopotamian plains. And isn't it ironic? You know, it starts in the Mesopotamian plains where we are today. Empire has been the normalcy of civilization. We tend to think, well, civilization is about music and art and literature and all that magnificent stuff, which it is, of course. Very often on the back, of course, of an empire. Sometimes at its most fruitful times. So if civilization has always been imperial, then Paul is not against Rome because he wants, say, a Jewish empire or an Irish empire, maybe. It's because there's something wrong with civilization, not with human nature, but with civilization. It always goes imperial, which means unjust. And he is, his language, say, of a new creation, I don't find even, you know, hyperbolic. It's like we're going to have to go back and start all over again because our, using my metaphor, our drug of choice in civilization has been violence. And we're now getting to the point where the withdrawal or the continuation are about equally awful. So Paul is really challenging civilization on its basis. Why is it always imperial, he wants to know.
What did Paul do that was most challenging of the Roman Empire?
What Paul is doing is really setting up, I would almost say, an alternative empire, because he is not just sitting down in one place. He's moving around the whole Mediterranean, and what he is doing is setting up small little cells, as it were, in the major cities. If you watch what he does, he goes straight for the capitals. He's in Thessalonica, capital of Macedonia. He's in Corinth, capital of Achaia. He's in Ephesus, capital of Asia. And he grows up in Tarsus, capital of Cilicia. He's a man of capitals. And his strategy is to go to the capital, set up your little cells of an alternative lifestyle. They'll go out to the other cities, and maybe they'll get to the countryside eventually. And his method of doing it is setting up these tiny Christian, he calls them assemblies. We translate them as churches, which throws us off. They're really, the Greek word is ecclesia, which is the word for the at least male members of the city when they come together to decide the city's destiny and fate. And I imagine him in the shops. I think that's where he would meet, not in the villas or not in the houses or the tenements, but in those shops you can still see all over Roman cities. They're maybe 10 feet by 10 feet. And people coming in and out is not going to draw any attention to themselves. Small little groups, 10, 15, we're not talking huge, but there might be 3, 4, 5 in any given city. There's certainly 6 or 7 in Rome alone. But they're all over the place. It's not so much whether they are 1,000 Christians by the year 50, but whether there's 10 in 100 cities.
Paul believed that the end of days was near and that the second coming would happen in his lifetime. How did that affect his view of the Roman Empire and what should be done about it and his view of what the righteous life was?
And by the way, thank you, Terry, for saying the end of days, because sometimes what people say is the end of the world. And in the first century, Jews and Christians never imagined the end of the world because only God could destroy creation. And God would never do that since God had created it and said it was all good. We can imagine the end of the world because we can do it, unfortunately. So what Paul is claiming, like Jesus before him, is that this great period of what he calls justification, meaning making the world a just place. It's a very simple everyday word. It sounds strange to us, but justification. Augustus would probably say, oh, that's what I'm doing. Yep, I'm making the world just. So Paul talks about justification. And what he is declaring is that the end of days when God would make the world just has already commenced. Now, you're also quite right in saying that he tells us, and don't worry, it'll be over soon. Because any radical mutation in thinking, we always want to say, well, it's not that great a radical. It's just a minor thing. Now, he was wrong on that. And my advice is simply get over it. The more important thing, though, is he was insisting that it has begun and God is calling us to participate with God in the process, rather than us waiting for God, as it were. It's a dialectical process between God and us. Nobody's waiting on the other. This has to be done together, not us without God, not God without us. Otherwise, it would be impossible to explain why Christianity didn't dribble out after about 2 generations in acute disappointment. But he was simply wrong about the minor point. Now, if you want to say, well, the second coming, is still off in the future, and when he said soon, that means today, well, good luck. I would simply say anyone who has talked about the future, let me speak within Christianity, has been wrong. It might be time to begin to wonder, is our assertion about the second coming our refusal to accept the first one? And is this idea of a non-violent Jesus just something we can't handle? So we want Jesus to come back and do it right. Come back and get it right. Come back violently, in plain language. So the real question about the second coming is, do we or do we not believe in a violent God? And did Jesus and Paul proclaim or did they not proclaim a violent God?
Now, I should say, listeners who are listening to us might be thinking, have they changed format? Is this a religious show now? Because we're talking, I mean, we're literally talking chapter and verse here.
Right.
So I'm wondering, for anybody who isn't Christian who's listening and who isn't interested in studying Paul because it tells them more about their religion, what historical significance does your book about Paul have, and what relevance does it have for people today who are not necessarily followers of Christianity?
Well, we've just gone through an election in which the conservative right in this country assumed a monopoly on Christianity, on moral values, on biblical traditions, and probably at least indirectly on Jesus and Paul. What this book does, as the earlier book Excavating Jesus does, is insist that there is another vision of Christianity and of the Bible and of moral values, which is equally Christian. And I'd even go on to say that 4 years from now, if the Democrats want to be able to meet the Republicans on an even field, they better do some theology. And they better learn to put their theological language in public discourse. For example, I can talk about Jesus and Paul, or I can talk, using Christian language and all the rest of it, I could use Paul's Greek term dikaiosune, justification and righteousness, or I could translate that into global justice, which is what it is, by the way. I'm not just, you know, flipping it. Paul is asking, how is this world, the world, he would say God's world, but let me say the world, to be maintained justly? And justly simply means that everyone gets a fair shake at it. That is public language. It actually is the language, since I am in Philadelphia, of all people being created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's not what Paul is saying, but that's the way we said it. So this is actually transcendental language. You make a claim that all, let me say all people, are created equal. That's an imperial claim almost. It's a transcendental claim. It is, in plain language, a theological claim. And if the T word, theology, is a dirty word for some people, then they better at least learn how to oppose it with public discourse language.
I want to get back to the fact that Paul believed that he would witness the second coming of Christ in his own lifetime, and that the end of days was near. Many Christians believe that today, that the second coming is imminent, they will witness the end of days, and there's a vision of the end of days that says that those who have been born again will rise to heaven, and everybody else will be left behind on earth to face the tribulations. And this is a vision that is, among other things, described in a very popular series of novels called the Left Behind series. That's co-authored by Tim LaHaye, who was one of the founders of the Moral Majority and who is one of the leaders of the new group that was just founded by Jerry Falwell, which is kind of like a new vision of the Moral Majority. So do you think that today's vision of the Second Coming is affecting either culture in America or politics in America?
Yes, I do. I think it's infecting it, not just affecting it, but it's infecting it with a sort of a culture of violence, first of all, because it says, in effect, that God's final solution to the problem of evil is to kill the evildoer, rather massively. the rider on the white horse in the apocalypse is going to have blood up to the bridles for 200 miles, which is a pretty ghastly scenario. And I think it does infect us in general, but it also infects us in particular that when it was communism against capitalism, as it were, and both had the atomic bombs, and they held one at bay because we sort of could trust that nobody would do anything really stupid. If I imagine religious fundamentalism of any sort, but we're talking for the moment about Christian fundamentalism, which has atomic power, I don't mean it's going to go out and destroy the world someday, but it could do this, which leads to that, which leads to this, which leads to that, and at that point we have no alternative, let's say, but use the atomic bomb. It could have a certain carelessness about the faith of the world, since it presumes that it and people like it are going off to heaven, to a better place, and that maybe God is consigning the world to hell, as it were.
Do you think that the center of mainstream Christianity has shifted?
I think what has happened is the center has grown flaccid, weak, uncertain of its message, can give you a whole list of things it doesn't believe in or you don't have to believe in or that are in the Bible but you don't have to follow, many of which are quite correct, by the way. But it hasn't a positive message. A lot of the positive message, the message of a Jesus or a Paul, I find myself being told, well, you're just talking politics. And I say, no, I'm talking at the point where politics and religion cannot be separated, maybe distinguished, but cannot be separated. I'm talking at the same level that Paul, looking at a silver denarius that said Caesar was the son of God, couldn't say, well, now Caesar is political, but son of God, that's religious. I think at the deep level you cannot separate religion and politics because we cannot separate body and soul at a deep level.
I think I've asked you this before on Fresh Air, but do you practice religion anymore?
I may have answered the same way that I would have to say I don't know the difference between prayer and study. This is what I think about all the time. This is the default condition of my mind. I don't mean I can't do all sorts of other things. I don't. But if I'm out jogging, for example, this is what I'm thinking about. Not because I think I should, because I don't know how not to. I don't consider that practicing religion means whether you go to church on Sunday. That's one way of doing it. And sometimes that is 1 hour a week. I've spent most of my time in the last 30 years trying to live with Jesus and to walk like Jesus, and a lot of time to walk where Jesus walked and where Paul walked. I think that's what it means to be a Christian. It's not a statement that you can be a Christian by not going to church. It's not a statement that you can be a Christian by going to church. It is a question of what's on your mind most of the time. What are you thinking about most of the time?
Do you pray?
Yes. But for many people, I noticed that prayer is sort of asking God for stuff. I try to bring my whole life into the presence of God. And what I take very seriously is how the human will gets in some kind of unity with God without deluding itself. A very simple thing. As a scholar, I have to read all sorts of people telling me how wrong I am. I can't simply say, well, you're all wrong back, because I have to, in public very often, comment. So my own will is constantly being challenged. I don't know how people who say, well, I've prayed over it and I've decided, I don't know how they have not simply certified their own will as the will of God.
So prayer or religion for you isn't about self-affirmation or about giving you more of a sense of certainty?
No, and I have been asked, well, don't you have doubts? Well, first of all, you have to have certainty in order to have doubts. And I consider that this is in the title of the book, In Search of Paul, it's a search. It's an ongoing search. Now, I'm quite willing to say this is what I think we have found, and this is what we're trying to live by, so it's not just all in the future. But it's an ongoing process. So certainty doesn't come up. Trust comes up, faith comes up, hope comes up, and charity comes up, as it were. But certainty, I don't find that term too often in the Bible, except in the sense of trust, in the sense of intellectual certainty, like 2 and 2 is 4 or something. That doesn't seem to be a concern of the Bible. What is very much, can you trust this God? Yes. Could you love this God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind? Yes. Could I trust Jesus? Yes. Do I trust Paul? Yes. But that's an act of faith. It's not simply, it's an intellectual proposition and I find it rather interesting. No, it's a commitment of life. It's not simply a set of propositions that you find, that you approve of. It's a challenge of life that I find I can barely live up to, but I think it is right.
John Dominic Crossan, thanks for talking with us again on Fresh Air.
It is, Terry, as always, a great pleasure and an honor.
John Dominic Crossan is Professor Emeritus of Religion at DePaul University. His new book is called In Search of Paul.